This is the Boundless Pursuit Podcast, a show highlighting the purity of the experience without limitation. Each week, we'll bring anglers as diverse as the fish they chase, whether it be from your backyard or your bucket list. Freshwater, saltwater, conventional gear, or fly, we're bringing stories and perspectives from fishermen from all walks of life, from across the country and globe. In the digital age, authentic communication and networking is critical, and I'd love to hear from you about show suggestions, potential guests, or general feedback. And you can reach me at boundlesspursuitfishing@gmail.com or at my website, www.boundless-pursuit.com. That's where you'll find the entire collection of written articles, podcast episodes, and media. I deeply value the feedback, ratings, reviews, and support of my listeners, and I look forward to hearing from you. I'm your host, David Graham. Now let's get on to today's episode. I am really excited about this one today because the stuff that these guys are doing is what dreams are made of. Nicola Vitali of Italy and Johan Freiberg of Norway are adventure anglers from Wild Sea Expedition, a small group of diehard travelers who searched for untouched waters and established expeditions in some of the most pristine ocean systems on Earth. And managing the operation is Nicola Vitali, a lifelong angler and adventurer who has traveled the globe, chasing fish by all means in freshwater and saltwater. He's a guy that epitomizes the very term adventure angler, researching and committing time to explore new and untouched waters for some of the most prized fish on the planet. In helping with booking and logistics, and just as an information resource or whatever else is needed to make the experience seamless, is Norwegian angler Johan Freiberg, whose deepest passion lies in tropical destinations for fly fishing, the exploration of new places, and unlocking their potential. And after having crossed paths in their respective journeys, the two comprise part of a collective effort in Wild Sea Expedition, which now hosts trips to Djibouti, the remote island of Socotra, the Nubian reefs and flats of Sudan, the pristine archipelagos of Venezuela, and recently exploring the jungles of West Africa and Gabon. But beyond their knack of finding new places and exploring them is the remarkable quality with which Wild Sea Expedition captures the moment, both in photography and videography. The imagery displayed in some of the projects that they've been involved in is astounding. Beautiful cinematic views of places, people, and of course fish, where oftentimes they depict species like giant trevally, tarpon, various species of parrotfish and triggerfish, the Napoleon wrasse, different species of tuna and snapper, by fly on the flats or in open water jigging and popping. I spent hours looking at the video projects that they produced, and I was stunned. I'd go so far as to say that it's among the best fishing-related videography anywhere. Truly top tier. And this was just an awesome pair of guys to talk with, where world-class species of fish were the foundation of conversation, built on a journey of exploration and adventure. Because that's the whole point. The opportunity to explore. An opportunity that seems to shrink year over year. I could not be happier to be joined by international adventure anglers Nicola Vitali and Johan Freiberg of Wild Sea Expedition. Anyway, guys, we've rambled on quite a bit before hitting recording, so I appreciate your time. I know that y'all are constantly traveling, so I try to catch the travelers while I can. But Johan, Nikolai, like I said, I'm gonna try my best with the pronunciations, but I think that might be the best I can do. I know that the invites probably come off super random. Every time I reach out to people, I'm like, they're going to think that I'm just some random guy. But I promise you, they're not as random as they seem. I am constantly, like, the biggest, most consummate fan of fishing media, fishing videos that you'll ever meet. Always searching, looking, watching. And I had seen y'all's films, like the Wild Sea Expedition films, like short films for the most part. Most of the ones I've found have been relatively short, that were so spectacular, so remarkably well done. I'd go so far as to say they're the best fishing videos that I've seen anywhere of any sort. So I knew, I was like, gosh, I've I got to talk to these guys. But, you know, sometimes those are the kinds of people that don't respond. So first and foremost, I appreciate your quick responsiveness and openness to doing this podcast. Yeah, I really want to get into what Wild Sea Expedition is. So let's just start there, I guess. I mean, that's kind of how I found you, was the videos. But then, you know, I still have a lot of questions. I would really like to know, either Nikolai, Johan, y'all can just kind of ping pong back and forth off of what you know, or at least how your paths converged. Because obviously the team that you have seems to be diverse. Like, what is it, four or five guys, but everybody's from different areas. But
yeah, a bit less actually, yeah.
Okay. Well, if we're going to start anywhere, I guess let's just start with, like, what is Wild Sea Expedition? What are your roles in it? And how did it come to be?
Yeah. So I guess I reply.
You do.
So, okay. Well, it's a long story. I will try to make it short. So in 2008, I've done my first exploratory fishing trips with some of my best friend at the time. And then we went to Maldives, spinning for GT and other stuff. Since then I finished my degree and I wanted to explore new fishing spots. So I was fascinated by Sudan, Eritrea, trout in Ethiopia, everything. And there was no, I mean, internet was not what is today. So, I mean, 15 years, 16 years ago was a little bit more intriguing because we still use like paper magazine and and stuff like that, you know. And I was talking with my friends like, we should go to Sudan. Imagine how it is. The world was like, the world was much bigger place and many, many things still unknown. So, then we, just with friends, we did some exploratory fishing in Socotra, which is in Yemen, for spin fishing for Big GT. And the next year, that was 2011, I just ended up in Sudan for very fortunate coincidence. And what I wanted to do in life was to just do fishing expedition and having fishing operation. So I came back home and there was this little steel catamaran made in like 1972 for sale in Sudan. And the guy that took me the first time in Sudan was an Italian, is still one of our partner. And he told me, maybe we can buy it and do fishing. And I was like, okay. And with nothing, like very cheap, it was rotten. We bought it. I was 25. I just finished my degrees and just bought a boat in Sudan, and the adventure started. So, and same time, I also started Socotra. So those has been the two business that I started with. And clearly, imagine to explore an entire country. Sudan is huge.
Yeah.
It's 550 kilometers of coast with flats, island. So it took many years. So having our own boat, we were inviting friends and guests and constantly develop the exploration, the fishery. And same we did in Socotra. And then in 2015, the war started in Yemen. So we lost that thing. And then I just jumped on Eritrea and Djibouti to explore new waters. So Saudi Arabia was still closed, was not possible to go. So it's always been like a constant developing, exploring. With the idea of building up the entire area, because the Red Sea has many spots, many countries, and a lot of things to explore back then. And then COVID came, then Yemen opened again, then COVID came. And basically Yon came as a host. He came with a group in Sudan in 2019.
Okay.
And then he came again in. You came in 2020 as well.
Yeah, I think we did the Sudan, And then I went, we talked, and then we went to Eritrea in
Yeah, that
November
was in
2019.
2019. Yeah,
Yeah.
19, yes.
And then on and on from this.
Yeah, so he came as a host. Then in 2020, we improved all the operation with bigger boats, better boats in Sudan, because the time was right. So the fishery was worth to invest and have a better operation. And then COVID came. Then we start again. 2021, 22, 23 has been great years. It's been very, very good. And yeah, we just got involved more and more and more. He likes this type of destination adventure. And he started to get involved more and more with us. And yeah, we share the passion to exploring new waters. We found together some very good hot area in Sudan and in Socotra. So yeah, that's what keeps us thrilling all the time.
Yeah. So I where I get kind of interested is obviously I notice that there's a great emphasis on where you're traveling, being around like the Gulf of Aden, the Red Sea, like that region seems very specifically, well, not entirely, but a great emphasis is on there. But then I think, I understand if I'm not mistaken, where are you from? Italy?
Yeah, me, I'm Italian.
Okay,
Johan
and
is
then
Norwegian.
so. You know, then my question then becomes, when you get this idea to start exploring and traveling, I feel like maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like not a lot of people, especially 15 years ago, would have, people would be like, I want to go to the Amazon. I want to go to Africa. I want, the areas that you're kind of, you hear a lot. Nobody says that they want to go there, at least I wouldn't think. So it's like, where did the idea come from to fish there? Because I don't know what the nature of the fishing is like in Norway or in Italy, but it seems like it would be a far cry from that style of fishing. So like, when you start getting this idea to go travel somewhere, how did that place come to mind?
It was unfished. Somebody had to do it.
So you're just looking at maps and say, here's an interesting area.
Yes, and
Okay.
nobody is doing it. So
Yeah.
we go and check it out.
Yeah, that's cool. It's because like, and the other thing too is like, like there's, and that may be kind of what we do as part of this conversation is some myth busting, but there's this idea that region, especially as you get closer to like the Horn of Africa, is dangerous. And it's not where you want to travel, and it's the people are unfriendly, or if you have white skin, maybe that's not a safe place to go. Is
Yeah,
that
we could do a long talk about this. I mean, it's there are we need to separate two concepts. One concept is the safety, and one concept is the trouble that an area is going through. So Middle East is historically a trouble area for political and economical reason, which doesn't mean that it's unsafe for people. While, for example, South America is unquestionably more unsafe than Middle East for people. The difference is that in the Middle East, the violence and the unsafety is not in the society. So you are walking in the street and you don't have people that rob you in the street. Then clearly it depends where you go. I mean, if you go to Syria around Damascus, okay, that around alone on your own. But if you are traveling with right people and you know the area, and I mean, there is no real risk in the society, in the street. While in South America, you just go on your own in the street and people rob you because violence is in the society. Is, you know, it's a very different concept. Then having logistical troubles and troubles in the area, it's something different, but that's a sort of political stuff, which is very, very different. And but yeah, people look at media and they think the perception, the real perception about safety is it's very shift. Like you think you get to the airport and because you are white, they're going to kidnap you or shoot you right at the airport. Like people are really like sometimes very, very afraid. And then you get to the place and you realize it's like a normal place.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's, I've always wondered why that is. That's, I will say, you know, I don't know how it is in other places, but I know that's a big thing here in the United States is that everything else is dangerous. Everywhere else is terrible. You know, we're the greatest. And I've had nothing but great experiences in these other places. And I knew it would be that way. I think I had the foresight to know that that's a bunch of bull crap because, part of it's probably because I've had experience as a law enforcement officer here in the United States. So I've seen the worst side of our society. And there are streets here, right here in the United States that I'd go so far as to say it's more dangerous to walk down some of these neighborhoods than it is to walk through Afghanistan, like war-torn area. Like it's so that's a reality. But yeah, man, that's I always think that that's an important side of it to establish this idea that it's things are unsafe and that therefore not worth going to. It's a great tragedy that I've seen people keep themselves from experiencing something truly special because that
very true.
That idea stood in their way. But at the same time, you know, again, the it's such an ambitious or like massive undertaking, especially when you go to a place that has never been explored, just the logistical mess to untangle. I want to kind of get into that because that interests me. I love the adventure element of it, you know, because it's one thing to go to some of these amazing places, but there's a nice lodge set up. There's an itinerary that's very structured. You're going to be chauffeur. People are going to be waiting for you at the airport, holding a sign with your name on it. Like you're not going to get lost. So for you to go and almost sort of do like, be like a frontiersman or a pioneer in some way is one. It's an amazing thing because it seems like it's rare in this day and age to find something that's truly untouched. But I want to continue to backtrack a little bit because if you just cannonball straight into that, people are like, well, shit, I can't really relate to that. I'm curious in both of your respective origin stories as anglers. You know what I mean? You began somewhere. So like the fishing journey must have started in Norway fishing for whatever was in your backyard or in Italy for, you know, I don't know what you have there, pike, trout. So I guess just kind of give me the quick rundown on your start as an angler, where you're from.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I grew up in Norway, small town, started fishing when I was like 3. Mm. And then it was just something just twitched in my head and that was it. Started fishing for trout, perch, all this. Lived really close by the river, so like always just 5 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
And then it progressed from that. I mean, I was fishing a lot in Sweden when like growing up because my father lived there. And then, I mean, I was always like watching these old... I think it was Orvis or something made these fly fishing videos from Florida.
Yeah.
catching tarpon, bonefish, permit, la la la, all this. And I was always like intrigued by these species. And so I ended up just going on a trip DIY with my ex-girlfriend when I was like 22, something like this.
Yeah.
And I went to Tobago, I think it was, and just snowballed from there. And I went there a few times, got some tarpon, bonefish, all of this, and then ended up in the Bahamas. And I did many trips there, like more than 20. Also running like assisted DIY fishing operation there with an American guy, a friend of mine.
Okay.
And then, I don't know how I ended up. I ended up in the Middle East, in Oman. I think this was like 2016 or something. And I met a actually on the second trip there, I met a friend of Nicola. And we started talking, and then after that, I got in touch with him. And well, the rest is history, you know. Started talking, and I came to Sudan, Eritrea, Sudan, and then all over the place after that. So it was like I was very like steady in the Caribbean for I've done like I don't know maybe, more than 30 trips I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Around the Caribbean. That was kind of my area. And then I went on this DIY trip to Oman just to check it out. And I had to do it again because it was fucking shit the first time. And then I got in touch with Nicola and yeah, we clicked and started checking out other stuff after that. So, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's been an interesting, very interesting ride. Yeah.
Yeah. And
Oh.
then Nicola, in Italy, I mean, where you kind of start getting your kicks in all of this? Is it is this something that's being facilitated too by like a grandpa, a father, oh,
No,
everybody
that's
in the
great.
family fishes, or were y'all like the black sheep who you're the only ones in the family that fished?
Yeah, I was the black sheep. No, just went random. When I was something like three, I saw a guy with a fishing rod in a jetty, and I asked my parents to get a fishing rod. And then, like, a family friend was bringing me fishing when I was small, and then my mom missed my father. And then, yeah, she was bringing me fishing, and I just grew up fishing. As I had the age, I could drive a scooter, bought a scooter, and just explore all the creeks up in the mountains. After the creeks, I started fish spinning. I always fly fish, but nobody teach me. And then, yeah, and then explore Wells catfish, catching bigger and bigger catfish on spinning. Bigger and bigger fish, and then first step Maldives. So I started as conventional popping and jigging fishing, and as I noticed that Sudan had a lot of potential for fly, there were a lot of flats. I started to check it out. We had a partnering with African Waters back then. It was thread fishing. So yeah, we started the business step by step, exploring, and I just went more and more into fly fishing, and now I'm fishing like 99% fly. So I'm pretty much done with top water. I mean, I caught a lot of GT, amberjack, any sort of yellowfin, bluefin. So all I want to do is fly fishing. It's just much better.
Well, probably add a layer too is of challenge, but I love the
Yeah,
I love do what
I
now? Go
want
ahead.
to side fish. It's a little bit more specific. So
Yes.
That's hard to beat when you can actually see the target, excitement wise. But it's always funny when you hear the stories of guys that meet, especially when they're from two different areas and establish stronger bonds. I'm like convinced when you start traveling further from home, there's like less people doing that, but the passion that the people that have doing that is so much more intense and so much more matter of fact. That you can immediately, like, you can immediately know, what their intentions are, what they're about. It's easier to get along with people, cut from that cloth.
It's very true, because you don't get across many people like that. So it's not like with everyone, it's we go there, we explore, we do this, we do that. So yeah.
I think it's, I've found that just in a little bit of traveling that I've done and the guys that I've encountered, I immediately hit it off with them and got along with them for the most part. But, hell, if I went to some fishing function here in Florida with a bunch of anglers showed up,
I don't know, it's a very different story. The whole thing.
I probably wouldn't have a, you know, maybe I wouldn't have as much in common, or I just wouldn't get along with. I get along with everybody, but I wouldn't be as maybe necessarily as interested. But yeah, I've found that. I think it's that's an interesting thing. It's especially when you start looking at people that are doing broader traveling. It seems like too the community gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and there's very recognizable faces. Like, it's almost like everybody knows everybody. Or like when I start doing research about some of these places, I without fail I'll run into some of y'all's photos and your videos. Or there's a select few other people. It's like, oh, it's, well, it's that guy. It's this guy. So the community becomes very small. But yeah, that's interesting. But I get real interested in the early travels. And this is where I get fascinated, is going to a place that has never been gone to before, at least for fishing, or has barely been gone to before. I get caught up in wondering how, like, who, you got to know somebody. You have to reach out, I would think, to somebody who has access to certain land, to certain resources. You're forced to communicate at some point with people. But I guess, Nikolai, when you first started trying to lay out these plans to go to these places, well, what did that look like? I mean, how are you, and this is like pre-internet as well, so now you have even less means of reaching out to somebody. You know, what did that look like?
Yeah, it was cool. Actually, it was like the cool part of the thing, you know, that I'm kind of missing now. So every time there is a sort of potential adventurist exploratory, I'm like, fuck, I'm in. So,
yeah.
well, places are different. So depend to the place, you have different dynamics going on. Sudan, I have to say, it's been pretty easy because Sudan, it was a popular diving destination.
Okay.
And I went in touch with this guy, Italian, that he has a boat. He had a boat in Sudan. So I was living close to me, and he told me, yeah, come on my boat and check if it's good for fishing. Because in Sudan, you have no facilities, nothing. So the coast is wild. You were not allowed to camp. It was very complicated. So only way was liveaboard. So that was the bridge. While Socotra, we went with an agent, with a local agent, and we brought our camping equipment in the very beginning. But then you have a person that is helping you with a very basic start. But then to develop everything else, it's been a journey. So actually it's been easier in the beginning just to get there, because you have local tour operator that can provide you with a tent and take you to a place and say, okay, you can go fishing. But then to get to every place I wanted to be, that has been like the trick. And that's why I had to learn Arabic, and it took many years. Because then people try to, I want to go to that place. Boat is very expensive. It's going to cost you $10,000. So then you learn the language and you find out that the boat is costing $4,000. You know, and it's like, and you sorting out all your stuff. So, it's been a crossing, you know. Then when there was a bridge, the bridge become a bit stronger. But then I just made my own things. So every place is a bit different, yeah. But you need to create your space slowly, persistency.
Yeah,
a lot. Jeez.
And how are you getting intel, like, on the fish? Is it just a hunch that the species that you're looking for are even there? Are you even looking for a certain species? Or is it just let's go throw some plugs and see what lives here? You know, because I wouldn't think you have. I don't know if the locals are super familiar with the quarry of sport fish, but you know, how are you?
We expect, being in the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea, you know, more or less you're gonna find the GTE and but then
you recognize different areas quite easily, and what to expect from each place. Yeah, No.
And what are you looking for, like reef edges or something? Or is it, you know, you know that they come through there. So now that you know that they come through there, well, I know that they favor this type of structure, this type of whatever. You know, what are you looking at? Like, are satellite images of the water to know what area you're going to go to? Or are you just literally blind looking at it from ground level? Or above?
Satellite. Satellite is the way to go.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. But then again, there are so many places that, I mean, they look very promising when you are like on Google Earth masturbating. and you're like, ah, yeah, it's going to be so sweet. And then you get there and you're like, because many structures can look quite similar. So at the end of the day, many places you really have to see it, but it's a very good start to have the satellite images for sure.
Yeah.
And when I started fishing, I didn't have this shit. Like, didn't have any satellite, no nothing, just went winging it.
Yeah.
And it's a struggle. You have to chew through a lot of murky water before you find gold. But then again, when you find it, and then you get this, like, I don't know, this feeling in your spine, you know, when you know that you hit something right,
mm-hmm.
which is different. And,
The smell.
Yes, exactly. And you kind of feel it in a different way.
Yeah.
But first off, of course, satellite images is it's a huge advantage.
I can't imagine like the discouraging feeling of having a hunch, doing that research, showing up and striking out and not getting anything. Yeah. you know, I would think a lot of people would just quit.
That's just a part of the game. And then you have to, okay, fuck it. Then I messed up and we have to do something different next time. Or different tides. There can be, seasonal changes also. So it's very hard to look at a spot one time and say that it's nothing.
Right. Well, the other thing too is, you know, it's what's interesting is the idea that it's a brand new fishery. And I imagine, are you going there with the intention of looking at a potential place to set up an operation or just a potential place to go for yourself? I guess if you're going there as a potential place to set up an operation, I would think you'd have to go there several times because it's weird when it's a new fishery because you have absolutely no idea how the fish are going to respond to, you know, I don't want to say pressure, but that I guess that's the best word for it.
Yeah.
What effect, how many people are you going to let come in on the next group? Is it like a slow progression? Like, hey, you know, next season we should have no more than 10 people fish this place. And the season after that, maybe we'll bring it up, you know, higher. Do you look at things from that standpoint or because I would think, you know, it's a long process before you really open the doors for it to be a fully functioning, you know, operation where people can book tours and things.
Yeah. Now, to me, about pressure and everything, that's a very big thing. Most places, even though they are big, they need rest mm-hmm. for sure. Like in Sudan, how we fish there, it's a rotation of maybe like 10, 14 days between every time they are fished. And also we're not talking small areas, they're very big areas. But still, it's a very small amount of pressure that you are actually able to put on
yeah.
with like six anglers. And then we give it a long rest. I've seen this so many times, like in the Bahamas when I started fishing there. This was like before Google Earth and all of this, so nobody really knew. Then in like 4 or 5 years, I think it went, and suddenly you could go into places that like normally nobody would ever fish, and you see footprints You see somebody been there with their car, so on and so on. And the fish are just acting very differently. And especially the town flats, you know, the close by places, the fish were just uncatchable, almost like very, very, very hard compared just to a few years earlier when you can go there and you'd catch like 6-8 bonefish every time.
Yeah.
As soon as you put the pressure, they're going to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think quite universal. If you put a lot of pressure on one spot, especially with residential fish, I mean, it's one thing with pelagics, because they roam around, but flats fishing, that's a lot about pressure. You can't put mm-hmm. too much pressure on the fish. Then you can just shoot yourself in the knee, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I always thought that'd be a tough part because you get so enamored by how incredible the experience is early when it's fresh. I would think it'd be easy if you don't have that foresight to think about the damage you could cause to just want to just come sprinting in there and catch as many fish as you possibly can. But
that's something that comes with experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if you are inexperienced, you just get excited and like, we can take 10 fishermen a week.
Yeah.
So we never did that because we always been a small operation. And I mean, even if you have two or three live aboard working with six guests, you are not that tiny, but you are not like a huge one. You know, we are not running five or six lodge or atolls, like not really big, but so even then, you know, with the wise rotation and 12 weeks a year, then you know that you're gonna preserve the fishery, because it's very easy to do your calculation. You know how many spots you have, and you know how many times a week you can fish them. So if you have enough, sometimes you don't. You fish one spot every 2 weeks. If this place is small and you fish it once a week, then you need to be careful.
Yeah. So when you're first, you know, this is another thing. I just get this mental image in my head. When you're first showing up to some of these places that, you know, probably don't even see a lot of visitors anyway. But then you're carrying camera gear or big trunks and long rod tubes and fishing tubes. I mean, what are the people thinking when you're showing up and you come all this way to go try to catch some fish? I mean, I would have thought and then let them go. Yeah.
Local people are not very, very rich, so neither very fat. So when you show up there, catch a snapper and throw it to sea, like,
Oh, geez. It's just like, the culture shock there that I'm sure happens. But I remember I was actually watching one of your videos earlier today, and it might have been in Sudan. I don't remember. I can't remember where it was, but this little lady, she didn't seem too happy that you had a camera going towards her. She had a stick in her hand when she came at you too.
But no. That one was Sadia. No, she was fishing. She was just talking to us. Was not.
Okay. Because you looked at the guy and like, oh,
he's friendly. No, that one.
Okay, that's good. I wasn't sure what to make of the video. I think you looked at the camera guy and you're like, oh, she's not happy that you're taking pictures of her.
I don't remember which one is. Maybe that one was not happy. And normally you don't go around. So I have to say, we didn't mention, because you mentioned all the video and the media stuff. So it's Robert, which is doing them. Mm-hmm. It's the third guy, and he's Croatian.
Croatia,
and he's now
yeah.
in Djibouti. So yeah. He's the responsible of all that. So we give him a shout.
He deserves one. The videography is spectacular, like movie quality, phenomenal.
It's not me or Jan. Jan is a good photographer, but all those it's Robert. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I, yeah. I mean, I could binge watch those videos all day long. I wish there was more of them. Maybe I need to find the vault of where all the hidden videos are. This is like, there needs to be more. But anyway, I want to kind of segue into more specific experiences. You know, this has been a little bit of a lead up into how things developed. But I noticed, or I read one part, and in fact, I think you even did a video diary of it that blew my mind. And the Socotra place, of all the locations that you have, some of those videos are probably the most incredible to me. But then on top of it, I read that you had actually gotten stuck there, apparently, during COVID. Did you get trapped there for like, maybe, I think it was said either, was it 4 months or what did I say, 4 weeks?
It was only 3.
Okay. But you, in any case.
It was much better than being in Italy.
Yeah. Really? Okay. That's interesting. Florida wasn't so bad. Florida, you'd have thought nothing ever happened. But yeah, I saw where y'all had basically, in any case, that was like always what people are, you know, that's like that story you think about when you talk about COVID, the people that got trapped in other countries or stuck in other countries or couldn't get out. And I see that, you know, maybe you'd at least spent some time stuck. I guess it's a matter of perspectives because you're stuck in a fishing paradise, but you're still stuck in a different country with different, you know, with different customs and courtesies and ways of life, and you're away from home. But that was one where I'm like, I got to ask about how that went down, like the experience of being kind of stuck there. But then also just Socotra as a location, if we're going to start talking a little bit more about the fishing, the environment, the types of species that can be encountered.
I will leave that part to Jon, okay. Which enjoys a lot. No, I can tell about the lockdown and the COVID stuff. So we were there, but I'm used to stay there for like 8 to 10 weeks. So it's not a big deal. The thing was that we started the season and we were on one of the outer islands. So there is not only Socotra, it's an archipelago made of 4 islands.
Okay.
And we were on the most remote one. And then this COVID thing started and we were in constant touch with satellite phone about evolution. And then Yemenia anticipated the flight out of Socotra of 2 days. And they did it without almost any advice. So we were not in time to sail back because it's a 12-hour sailing and then 2 hours car to get to the airport. So we lost the flight and I'm there with all my guests, my fishing guides. So it was not only me. But yeah, at that time in the world, there were plenty of people stuck in places, people stuck in many places. So after 17 days, it was, they managed all various embassies and stuff. They managed to make an evacuation flight. With the excuse to bring some medicine to Socotra Hospital, they made this flight to evacuate people to Abu Dhabi. So all my guests and the guides, they left. And only me, Robert, Eva, that she's a YouTuber, and a couple and other 2 Italians, we decided to just stay there. I mean, Italy was really, really fucked up. There were like 1,000 deaths every day, and people were locked at home, like pretty strictly. Didn't even have the airport closed, so I would have flew to Abu Dhabi and been stuck there. So
yeah,
and then it was just like, okay, we stay here. In 1 month, it's gonna be okay, and then 1 month, it's getting worse. 2 months, it's still like nothing happening. Everything is locked. We cannot go to Oman. Oman is closed. There is no flights. So there we start to get a bit nervous, and eventually this container ship show up and. Thanks God. We go to Abu Dhabi, 1 week sailing, 1 week quarantine on the boat. Done. Yeah, it was cool. Yeah. We did unlock a lot of having time without work, without clients, just having time in Socotra. It's been cool because I would say that experience unlocked many things for me. Just talking to people, understanding many dynamics of the island, So I know a lot now.
Yeah. I guess you had no choice. Well, yeah, because that's what throws me off is like if you're stuck in a place for long enough, I would think that, you know, especially if you're stuck there longer than you had anticipated, you know, you kind of show up to these places. I don't know how this works, but I'm thinking like money wise, for instance, I would think maybe you're starting to run out of like, you know, funding or the money to even get food or have a place to stay. Do you get support from like your government? Or are you able to like call somebody in Italy and be like, I need support?
Government, forget that. No, they yeah. land the flight. So that was okay. No. There was one of the guys, he had plenty of cash because his season was at the end. Mine was at the beginning. Mm. But you have Western Union if you want. So that wasn't an issue. As a place to stay, a local guy gave us a house for free that was belonging of an Italian couple. So we quickly restored it a little bit. We cleaned it. And we were staying there. So, yeah, it was very, like, basic living. My regret is that I couldn't go fishing much because of the money. You know, you don't want people to send you money over and over by Western Union so you can go fishing.
Yeah.
So, we were just going a bit fly fishing and exploring the island, enjoy as much as we can. And we were living wild, like camping on the beach.
Yeah.
Even we reached the point that we were just going out, me and Robert, without not even the gas tank. We were cooking coffee in the morning on fire, lunch and dinner on fire, sleeping on the beach with just a mattress, like proper castaway.
Yeah. So, well, I guess he probably, from a videographer, photographer, storyteller standpoint, is probably like, oh, this is great. This is good. We can make something out of this, but make lemonade out of lemons, I guess. It turn a shitty situation into something good.
Did you watch the movie?
I watched a short video because like the icon, the thumbnail is so interesting. It's just like you underwater, like it's like you jumped in holding like bear hugging a GT. Like, well, I'm like, what a crazy photo. You're like,
that's
I think
the
that
BKK one.
Which one was that?
It's the BKK one. It's the one for is the top where I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's one about the lockdown.
Okay.
Lockdown in Land of Dragons.
No, I did see that. That was like 24 minutes long, but I don't know if I managed to see the whole thing.
Check it out.
Yeah. Anyway, I better not.
That's good.
I'll do it when I get off the I'll be too tempted to start wanting to look at it while we're talking here. But the nature of the fishing is obviously that's the meat and potatoes for a lot of the people. Like, I love to know the trials and the tribulations and the things you have to overcome just to get there, because that makes it, that's where the value is. At the point that you catch the fish, it could be a small fish. A small fish can have a great deal of value to you if what it took to get there to get the fish is a greater story. So that's why I think that side of it needs to be told more. And especially from a video standpoint, just to touch on that, I get very turned off by typical sport fishing television that we have. At least here in the US, I don't know how it is elsewhere, where it's very corporatized. It's very, you know, they want the experience to look easy, and it was an easy experience provided to you by this product, you know, this thing made our, you know, it's, I don't like that because I can't relate to that. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? So it's, anyways, I don't like when I watch a video production where it just shows the showing up and the catching, you know, because then it's just highlight video. I'm like, well, that I can't relate to that, because every time I go out, I blow a tire. I got to find a way to like fix this problem. Like, you know, things happen. And I think that's what happens with most people. But the actual fishing, though, people want to know about the fish. And I will say, like, I think at this stage, most people are kind of associating that region with GTs. Like, that's kind of like the showcase species. That's the one that everybody knows. But you see these other things in these other fish that I even find as interesting, if not more so. But just give me a rundown. At least let's start with Socotra. I know y'all have other locations. I'm actually very interested in like the Nubian Flats, the Nubian Reef, or wherever y'all get those bumphead parrot fish, because that one is that's a very interesting one to me. But let's start. Well, I don't want to get ahead of myself. Socotra as a location. Just give me a rundown on what like the flats fishing is like, and then I know on the flip side of that, there's like the jigging and the popping out of the pangas or the boats out there.
Yeah, well, the flats fishing or like beach flats in Socotra, it's, I mean, the amount of different species is just astonishing. You can come down to the beach and we're talking like base camp almost, and you see schools of parrotfish. And then you start walking and you see more schools, and then you see bluefin and you see bonefish and you see GTs, you see everything. And most intriguing thing to me about this place is you find like typical reef fish, more like deep water fish in shallow water.
Oh.
So you can come across like African pompano, boar snappers, jobfish, stuff like this in 1 meter of water or less, even like backs out.
Oh, wow.
It's just something you never see anywhere else. And also, of course, there are bonefish there. Big, like meter fish, like grotesque size.
Yeah,
like you think it's not a bonefish, it's a milkfish, but turns out it's a fucking bonefish.
Yeah,
but just the amount of fish. They have never seen a fly before, and nobody's fishing there from the shore. I mean, there are local fishermen, but they are trolling for kingfish and stuff like this, yellowfin. But shore fishing, it's just unique. There's nobody there.
Netting, remember, netting is forbidden by the local community.
Yeah.
So nobody is touching the fish. So it's like going back like 100 years in time to the pristine state that things used to be. It's also kind of sad because you start comparing it to everywhere else that you know. That at some stage it must have been like this, but it's all gone. But there it's like just walking in a like a safari park. You know, there are, you see this, you see that. It's like you don't really know where to put your eyes because there are so many things. And we've had some incredible fly fishing there, especially like the first trip. Nicola and I, we were there, and I don't know how many species did we catch, like 18?
Can't remember. It was maybe 18 landed, 22 hooked or something
like
that. Yes,
something like this, yeah.
Jeez.
Like species
Major species, not
not that.
Triple spotted tail grouper or, like some rat like that, species.
Yeah.
What's good to hear that. I guess that's kind of another thing that I was wondering. Like you hear about these places that are pretty remote or pretty salt of the earth. And it's like this great tragedy that sometimes the locals don't realize that the resource, like they don't understand conservation. Or they don't understand the resource can be depleted and can go away. And you hear about these places where there's like severe, tremendous overfishing, and this is, or like horrible, horrible practices of pollution. But in this area, it seems that they're taking like the ocean health or the health of the sea pretty seriously.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, for some reason. Well, in Socotra, talking about Socotra, Let's say that the local fishermen, they have like a community or cooperatives, society. And every society has a boss, and they have rules and regulation,
mm-hmm.
like proper. So like lobster, it's full of lobsters, but they are allowed to fish for them only 1 week per year. So in that week, everybody come down from the mountains.
Yeah.
They go, they put cages, cage, net, they make a lobster massacre. And after that week, it's forbidden. Even if you are a tourist, you get to a village and ask, I want some lobster. No, forbidden. Netting is forbidden. So they take conservation pretty seriously. So that's good. It must be related to their history, to the toughness of the place that they live, but yeah, somehow it's very hard to find that everywhere else.
Yeah,
especially if you look at the people like in Abdel Kouri, and they are very poor. They are 40 kilo. They are very slim. Like you can tell, they are not eating a lot. So it would take them literally 10 minutes to walk from the village and put a net around a school of parrot fish and just have a feast, a parrot yeah. fish festival, but they don't do it.
That is, yeah, that's real curious. I guess that, yeah, because that's the other side of things, especially in an area where there's like famine, I don't want to say famine, but, you know, that's what
yeah,
you
it's
say.
A rough place. It's yeah, a very yeah. rough place to
just
live.
A lack of resources.
So, yeah.
Yeah, they have no resources, simple. So they don't starving, but they're not rich really at all. Like they're really poor.
Yeah. But man, how crazy to be able to show up to a place that's truly unspoiled and unruined. It's funny, Johan, that you mentioned that. I think that all the time, especially Florida is a great example of that. Like my home state of Florida. I mean, every time I go out, I always wonder and I think and I try to envision like what the place looked like before it was inhabited at all. Because it's just, I mean, it's like every week that I leave my house, you see a new development getting put up. You see another section of, you know, land getting mowed down so they can squeeze in more houses. It's like, yeah, golly, there's no untouched water anywhere. Yeah,
it's always molesting nature. Like, why?
Yeah.
You see that?
But then again, sad. Like, as you say about Florida, I mean, it's the story there. It could have been a hell of a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. No, that's yeah, very true.
Florida is doing. I mean, it's a very good example that it's actually okay. Of course, it could be better, but still, you have amazing fishery.
Yeah.
Compared to, I mean, with that kind of a development that's been going on the last 50 years, any other place it would have been shit. And I can also speak like as a Norwegian where we piss it away.
Yeah. Yeah. Our big thing right here right now isn't necessarily, I mean, they do a good job on regulations on the fishing itself, but like the big topic now with us is like, yeah, our big thing right now is water quality, which can destroy the fishing faster than overfishing. But you know, it's just a new battle. But anyway, yeah. So the fishing, the nature of the fishing there, is it like, are you having to be aware of, oh, you know, we got an outgoing tide at this hour? Is like reading tide cycles and things like that a big part of it? Or is it just at any tide phase and any moon phase? And then, you know, are there specific seasons that are best or?
It's tidal for sure. Both like pushing and dropping tide can be good, mm-hmm. but you need some kind of movement at water.
Yeah.
Spring tides is better because then you have a bigger flush and probably also colder water that comes from the deep. Because if the water is just standing still, then the fish, they're still there. They're sour, like very easily spooked, not really, not very keen to eat anything. And I mean, they've never seen a fly or a lure before, but it doesn't matter because it's something that's out of the ordinary and they just run off and they, they get like sour.
Well, I guess just give a rundown on some of the different species of fish, and that some of them may be things people have never heard of. I've tried to familiarize myself with most of them, but you know, on a good day during the best season, when you're walking the flats, what's an example of some of the you know, the types of species that you may encounter?
Oh, well, like the parrotfish, that's the bread and butter in a way. But there are, I don't know how many different ones, but there must be like 6-7 that we see frequently.
Mm-hmm.
You have the blue barred, which is the biggest one. The ones you've seen in the picture probably.
Yeah.
Like super pretty. It's blue and orange-ish.
Okay. Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful fish. Those you see in, like sometimes you see singles, but often they're in like small groups to big pods of like 30, 40 fish at the most. And you find them in like different areas. Sometimes like when we started out, we were fishing a lot of shit areas where there are a lot of fish, but also very snaggy. Mm. So if you hook something, then meh, you don't really stand a chance. So we lost a lot of fish, a lot of flies, because, okay, you can, of course, you can always hook something because they will eat, but you will never land it.
Yeah.
You have to like place your bets in a better way and try and find like at least semi-clean areas to fish for them. But then again, okay, you have the parrotfish, which are like, usually you see them shallow water, like from a meter, meter and a half to backs out like 20 centimeters. Feeding on algae, but they also feed on crabs, shrimp, stuff like this. Quite like docile fish. They just float around looking for stuff.
Yeah.
No. When
I look at the parrotfish's mouth, I'm like, how do you get a hook in that? Like,
yeah, that's also a big thing because that beak is, it's a clipper.
Yeah.
well, on my first trip there, we did pretty well. But then I think it was the second time.
The first time we landed the 50%. Second time we landed 10%.
Yeah. I got the record. Me and Nicola, he fucked up a lot. the trip before, when I wasn't there. How many you lose? You lost like 17.
I lost 20. No. I lost 22 in a row. I lost 22 or 23, and you lost 27.
Yeah. In a row.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
So, like, I was just, I was throwing my rod and I was losing my mind. Worst thing I've ever encountered anywhere was just fuck up upon fuck up.
Incredible. Yeah.
But I think with that beak is like the trick. Well, I can't really tell anymore. I had a theory. My theory was that if you don't set the hook instantly, just let them swim off, you get the hook on the side, like here. Mm. Or the leader, or the tippet, I mean. But after 27 lost, I don't know. I mean, my theory is out the window.
Yeah.
they have a little holes on the side.
Soft
and
spots.
We even landed some with the fly in the throat. And here, the beak have a junction. And sometimes the leader is just in between like a floss.
Yeah.
And some of the guests, you take them out. They go there for spinning. They bring a fly rod. You take them out. First fish, they hook it. They land it. Bam. So it's
Yeah.
They are not even really fly fishermen. They just have a hookup, bam, landed. So it's...
Yeah, I don't have anything clever to say about this.
No theory.
Yeah. No, but there are a lot of different species, of course. And next one is the bluefin trevallies, or the blue permit, as we call them. Like, usually the bluefin is a very catchable fish. Like, if you make a cast 12 meters away from the fish, it's gonna take the fly. It just comes running. In Socotra, not so much. They are super finicky. So you need like thin leaders, long leaders, and small flies, and maybe they're gonna take it. But there are lots of them. Like, in a trip, you're gonna see like 150 fish. Up and down the beaches, running around chasing bait fish. But usually it's just you make a cast, you lead them, and they just fuck off. No, they don't take it. I found a trick was just putting the fly on the bottom. And when they're like 5-6 meters away, just give it a lift and drop and pam. Then I got a few, actually, like, four in a row. But it's weird because usually that fish is one of the dumbest fish in the sea. They take whatever comes their way.
Yeah.
But they act like they're super educated. It's challenging.
Yeah.
And you also see, like, in the shallows, sometimes you see the boar snappers, like big ones. They're like usually like 6-8 kilos. And in super shallow water, they come like with their backs out almost, looking for crustaceans and stuff like this, which is like a fish you normally find on deeper reefs and catch them on poppers and stuff like this. So it's very interesting to see. And also the jobfish, green jobfish. Last time we hooked two and landed one, also in very shallow water. And that's also something you never see on the flat. I even had a tuna coming in and was tailing on my crab fly.
What the heck?
Yeah. I just saw something moving like along like a deeper edge of the flat. And it came onto the flat, and I put the fly out in shallow water, like maybe 50, 60 centimeters. And it dropped down, and I see this tail coming up, and it was, what the fuck?
Yeah.
It was a tuna. Yeah. Eating on the bottom like a bonefish, like, kank, kank, kank. And so you never really know what's going to happen. And I mean, Nicola, he got African Pompano also on the flat.
We saw more. We saw more and we saw ones.
Yeah.
Big ones, like 120 centimeter fish.
Jeez.
Yeah, that's very uncommon. In shallow water, it's very uncommon.
Which is a deep water fish usually.
Yeah.
You catch them digging.
I'm familiar with them. Beyond the flat, is it just a dramatic drop off or does it taper down?
It's tapered down.
Okay.
Yeah. And quite like, a lot of the areas are very clean. A lot of sand. Yeah. Of course, you have rocky, corally base and stuff like this, but the beaches are very clean. So if you hook a big fish, then even something big on a 20 pound, you stand a really good chance to land it.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Because it's clean. Especially if you hook something that's not like a trigger fish or a parrot fish that's going to find a hole and go into it. A substantial fish like a GT or something, you're going to land it. Even on light gear in the shallow flats.
Yeah.
Well, they're like the
GT. GT are pretty, for some reason, GT are pretty hard, like bluefin. So you see this GT of like 20, 30, 35, 40 kilo as your fly drop.
Damn, gone.
Everything, brush fly, crabs, shrimp.
Yeah.
Everything.
Are these fish all pretty easy to see, or are you like putting a drone up in the air to spot where the fish are at,
No, you see them.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be cheating, I guess.
The bonefish are very, very silvery, so they're quite hard to see.
Yeah.
And also some of the flats are like fairly deep, like a meter and a half. So they're quite tough to see. But apart from that, sometimes, I mean, you can see a fish like 100 meters away. It's incredible.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. Now, then offshore there, the flats are obviously, full of variety as a fish, but, when you're fishing off the shore, I guess from the boats jigging, popping, is it equally as diverse, or is there just,
It's insane. It's just insane. Like, that for me is hands down, the best GT fishery in the world. So there is a lot of talking about other places. We don't claim that. We don't have to, because we are fully booked without any publicity advertising. But it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. So the fish, the size of GT is big, and they are a lot. So in the latest trips, we had up to 80 GT in a week. Big ones,
golly,
60. And then if you jig, the amount of species is job fish, snapper, and different type of grouper, and trevally, yellow spotted, golden trevally, and it's just a long nose emperor, spangled emperor. So it's just every sort of available species there. So it's yellowfin and
also
mackerel.
The size of the different species is something you need to highlight.
Yes, and the size, the size. Fish are big. We caught bohar snapper up to over 15 kilo on popper. So the IGFA world record is now 16 kilo. Back then was like 15. And we caught it on popper.
Yeah.
So we caught not only one, and we caught few fish, 14, 14.5, 15, 15.5 kilo, I think was the biggest. So 94 centimeter is like, bohar snapper and green job fish up to 15. The every size, it's really, really big.
That an area that's pretty consistently open that you're running operations to? I noticed on your site some of the locations, I don't remember which ones, said like unavailable. Is there just...
Yeah, that's Sudan. Sudan, because last year in April, a war started.
Yeah, okay.
So, it's a sort of... but this is going to be, unfortunately, a long story. It's like a story of powers. So other countries, they want the control of Sudan. And so, it started. We don't know. I don't think it's going to be earlier than 2026.
Yeah. Yeah, that's unfortunate. I think one of them was, is that where the Nubian place, Nubian Reef?
Nubian Flat.
Okay. Yeah. I saw that one because I think that was one of the ones where I saw photos of the bumphead parrot fish. And, that just looks like such a I don't know if that one really gets held in much high regard in the circles of people who actually go to these places. But for me, every time I see the photos of those things, that is one of the most spectacular, incredible looking fish, freshwater, saltwater, any side of the earth, those big giant bumphead parrotfish are just an amazing looking animal.
Bumphead?
Yes. I think I think they're called bumphead parrotfish. The big, giant, like green ones with the huge thing on their head.
We never we hooked them in Sudan, but we never landed one.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's done.
Yeah. Okay.
No, we had them. We hooked a handful, but they too big. So we don't have small ones. So all the time we hook fish of 30, 40 kilo, and we got smoked. So we never landed one.
Ah, okay. I thought I'd seen a photo, and maybe on y'all's website or somewhere of one. But in any case, I guess if they live there, that's
maybe it was a Napoleon Russ.
No, I know those. Yeah, because I know they're kind of, there's some similarities in the way they look. Man, yeah, in any case, that's another one too, though, the Napoleon Rass. And I've brought that one up multiple times on this podcast as being one of those kind of underrepresented. Well, I think they're kind of growing in popularity now. But for the longest time, that was one of those ones where, you know, and again, I didn't realize that was a fish that you would catch up on the flats until I saw your photos holding them. I'm like, oh my gosh. But that's another.
Yeah, that's Djibouti. It has a very secluded spot with a very good healthy population of Napoleon.
Yeah.
Last trip, me and Yon, we had 12 shots in a day.
13.
And we've been slapped in the 13. Face all the time.
Yeah.
So 14, we had 12 shots.
Yeah. Oh, they get enormous too. I mean, that's another one. I don't know if the full size ones are coming up on the flats, but yeah, that's a fish.
We've seen them there of like 150 kilos, as big as they get.
It's another one though. Like their body shape, when I look at that, I'm like, that doesn't look like, you know, it doesn't look like a fish that would be hitting topwater lures, and yet I hear that they'll come up and smash a popper. It doesn't. It looks like a fish that. You know, I'm naive, but I look at a fish with a body shape like that. I'm like, that does not look like a fish that can move very fast. But then you hear these stories.
That's body shaming.
Yeah, I guess it is. So I look at it, I'm like, what an awkward shape, short, stumpy, fat fish. It just doesn't, you know, they must be full of surprises, but got an incredible looking animal.
Oh, they're full of shit.
Yeah. Well, now I'm confused about that bumphead thing. I'm going to have to, when we get off of here, I'm going to have to find what picture that was and send it to you and double check. Maybe I'm saying the wrong species. Who knows? But.
No, there was only one fish looking like this. Say what? Now I'm saying there's only one fish looking like you're describing. So for sure, it's a bumphead, but yeah. Probably somewhere else.
Yeah. I don't know.
The Sudanese ones that are just too big.
Yes, man, and that must be what it was. Man, my phone's froze up. I'm like, now I'm mad. I like want to make sure I'm correct.
Ah, you anyway. Are. It sounds correct.
Yeah. So that region. Place. I mean, that region. It seems like there's some crossover in the species. The nature of the fishing. It seems it's kind of similar in a few of them, but the just phenomenal fishery. But I know you've got a few operations that are nowhere near there. Well, I wouldn't say nowhere near it, but are y'all still doing trips to, I think it's Gabon, if I'm saying that right. Are y'all doing Gabon? Not now?
Yeah, I'm saying we're starting it now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because that's another one that I'm like, different, definitely a different scene, a different landscape. You know, that one seems so interesting to me. Yeah, what like what the nature of that one? I get confused by it because I'm sort of familiar with the area where they're doing this like land-based. It's like surf fishing or surf casting. I don't know if you're fly fishing there. The surf is rough. The water's dirt. The water's dirty. But I'm like, you know, how are you getting in there? Are you having a is there a river that leads into?
Yeah, it's actually like a giant mangrove system, like a big lagoon, but big, like many kilometers.
Yeah,
and you have like creeks and small rivers that are draining all the waters there. So it's actually looks like a big lake with some, like a lagoon, like an estuary, let's say.
Yeah.
So it looks like a river, but it's not really a river. It's like a big humid freshwater system. But then you have like salt water that it's going up the river a lot, and you know, in the deeper. So you can have saltwater sea species way inside. So the place that we are working on, it's not that good for fly fishing from the shore, because of the nature of the spot. But it's going to be interesting to develop the boat fishing for tarpon. That's what we are looking for. We saw a lot of big tarpon rolling just out of range. So we are, thinking of that. It's going to be something really cool. And the environment, the color is different. So Middle East, you have blue sea, white beaches, and desert landscape. There, everything is green and lush, and these brown waters. So the scenario and the colors is something totally different. It's very cool.
Yeah, that's crazy looking. And just the different wildlife around. I think I was looking at, I think I was reading on your website, like encountering elephants and, you know, all, I guess some of the things you would, that you associate with the experience of Africa. I don't know if I'd be happier. I don't know if I'd be happier or really upset to see an elephant in the wild. And there's nothing between me and
it. They are peaceful.
That's good. Yeah, well.
No, it's nice. It's nice.
Yeah, be shitting
bricks.
Being
surrounded by wildlife, having a feeling of being in a wild place, that's what you pay for, actually.
Yeah,
not
exactly.
To be like in a place where you know that everybody goes and you look around you and it's full of people.
Yeah.
Or you are driving to the fishing ground and you see other boats and guides. So it feels like it's all for you, all for yourself. The place is protected. Your money also goes into that, into the conservation thing. So it's special. Yeah.
Yeah. I know the size of the tarpon is really something else. And the barracudas there look enormous too. Like so big that I wonder if it's even the same thing that we have here in Florida. Like just gigantic.
No,
but
it's but not. What, I don't think it's the same.
Yeah, there's got to be some kind of genetic.
It's called the Guinea Barracuda. And that's the actually is the biggest one.
Yeah. Yeah.
It should be the biggest, bigger than the Great Barracuda. Yeah. And the tarpons are bigger.
Yeah.
Like really big.
Well, those land-based shore caught cubera, I think, is what's so interesting to me. You don't really see that many other places. Like a big monster cubera caught shore based like that. It just seems different. But I guess if that's one that's still in development. Yeah, I look forward to seeing more coming out of that area.
The reason it's always pretty much the same is that Gabon having a lot of national park and marine protected area. That's the reason why.
Yeah.
So as long as you go to other countries where you don't have that sort of protection, the places are just fished out.
Yeah.
So you have many other places that, coming back to what Jon said about how it was looking in the origins, you know. So Sierra Leone, I think it was, I'm not sure if it was Lefty Cree or Stu Apt. When they went exploring Sierra Leone for the first time in the 80s on fly, it was insane. So there was this guy that was running some tourism there, and he talked about this giant tarpon rolling. So they hire a live aboard from Senegal. They sent it to Sierra Leone with some Boston whaler. They flew in there, and he went fishing for tarpon on floating fly lines. And the first trip ever, it was insane. Insane. They caught so many huge tarpon. And then just, you know, step by step, the whole area, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Ivory Coast, and Angola. So many places has been just fished out slowly, 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 slowly. And yeah, it's probably, it was this, every West African spot was probably the same. And now it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, that's tragic, you know, but you hope some of these places get rescued, or at least the local places recognize the value that, like, you know, the value in what they have with their natural resources to potentially draw profit off of it. You know, you kind of hope that they see it before it's too late. But
yes, but, as long as there is like a lung, like some lungs of where fish can just live and reproduce and not getting destroyed, then it's fine. Yeah, it's a tragedy for many places, but as long as we still have something like that, it's a hope at least.
Yeah. All right, now are you still doing, I know now comes the part where I warned you about my, I might start bouncing around, but you know, I actually think the first video that I had seen just in my, like, for me personally, I tend to do more freshwater fishing than saltwater. It's probably just an availability thing, or for economic reasons. It's just a little cheaper. But I've always done a little bit more freshwater. But I think the first video that I saw of y'all's, or at least that you in particular were involved in, was like a fishing for arapaima. And I think it was somewhere in Peru. Now, is that, I noticed on your website, I saw the photos, but I didn't see it as a location. Are y'all still doing any work there, or is that, was that just kind of a, you know, a temporary thing? Or
no, we tried. I think the place has a lot of fish. The fishing is good, but fly fishing wise, which there it was what I really wanted to develop.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the consistency. So that place is in a national park. It has a lot of fish. It's very well conserved, I have to say. The problem is that you don't have a very consistent dry season. So that means you go fishing, you get like half meter more water, and then fishing is fucked. Like, and it's other places. I spoke with a friend of mine that is guiding in Guyana. They say like there, the water, it's very steady. So for arapaima, it's very, very important. As they feel the water level increase, they just go hunting in the bush.
Yeah.
And then you're just fishing in a lake that has 20% of the fish that it should. So that's the thing. We still do some spinning trip, but yeah, that's mainly conventional stuff.
Yeah.
Because fly fishing was tough. So I've been lucky. I caught a nice big fish. I have some friends, clients that did as well. But overall, you know, if you want to sell something as a commercial product, you need something that is doable by the normal client. You know, you cannot expect I fish for many years, many days a year. So you cannot expect people to come and fish 1 week nonstop.
Yeah,
for one fish. It's a bit, you know, it's not nice to fool people and promise. Like, you go there and you catch fish, and then it's.
Yeah, well, that's good ethics. I mean, yeah, I get that. That's a species that had probably been my number one, like, dream fish since I was a child, up until I caught one. But, you know, I caught mine with bait. Now I'm like, it was exciting, but I if the next time I do it, it'd have to be a different style. I don't know. It's you know, I don't do a lot of fly fishing at all, but even fly fishing or with lures or something, I'd like to, you know, if I do that one again, it'd have to be I'd want it to be more challenging. I don't know. I felt almost guilty on how easy. Maybe I just got lucky, but it came so easy, and I was like, "Oh man, you know, I've been dreaming of this."
It's easy.
Yeah,
on bait, it's easy. Yeah.
I'd been dreaming of this fish since I was a little boy, and you know, it's almost like this expectation had built up to have this like massive showdown with this fish, and I just showed up, and bam. I'm like, what? It's over.
massive anticlimax.
Yeah. So still it's a phenomenal species of fish, but yeah, the next time I do it, I gotta add in some layers of challenge beyond that. So
where you got your?
What'd you say?
Where you got your? Where did you
In Guyana. In Guyana. Yeah.
In Guyana.
Yeah. So but yeah, maybe the next time I'll have to it'll have to be fly fishing, it'll have to be on a lure. And if I don't get one, I really won't care because, you know, it's already been checked off. And I don't like putting that on my fishing trips, like that I need to catch this. You know, I'm like, well, you got me this time.
That's a good philosophy.
Yeah, it's better to do that. But anyway,
the strike is very cool. Eh?
You what? Like,
the difference that is the difference between catch it on like a spinning or fly.
Yeah.
The take is like
it wasn't necessarily the real deal, but there was one moment where we had you know, we were soaking chunks of bait, and my brother just wanted to reel his in to do like a bait check because the line had peeled out for a little bit and then stopped. And, you know, we're like, okay, maybe it could have been piranhas. You know, you're probably stripped. So he's reeling in. And all of a sudden, you know, we see this fillet of fish coming in. And then this, like, 7.5-foot arapaima's flying in behind it. And it came up. And just as he's lifting it out of the water, this thing exploded, showered water all over all of us. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, I was like, that's how I want to catch them, not just, you know, throwing a fillet on the bottom and waiting on them to gently start carrying it away. I couldn't believe a fish that big was moving that fast, though. Like, I mean, it was like that thing threw a bathtub worth of water into the boat on top of us. It was insane. But anyway, yeah, well, that'll be a trip for another day. I was like, I got other targets to cross off before them. But I figured, you know, do what?
There is so many targets.
Too many.
Yeah, too many. It's tempting to always go back for the ones that I've already done because I had so much fun doing them. But I'm like, nah, I got to get new stuff. But yeah, one thing I'm wondering, I guess, as we're getting a little closer to time that we would wrap up the podcast, do you have anything in the works? Well, I don't want to give away secrets, but any upcoming expeditions back to where you've gone before? Anything else new? I mean, we talked about Gabon, but you got anything hidden up your sleeve you're willing or able to release? Any new projects you're thinking about?
We got something in this fall, like October, November. Golden Dorado.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. Which very good size, big river, not like deep river, but wide and shallow, which looks amazing. So I'm going to spend 2 weeks there this fall. It's location X.
Yeah. Yeah.
With some different guys. Yeah. So if this works out, it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah.
They get like the fish there are generally, they're large, like from 15 to 30 pound.
Nice.
And bigger. And
yeah.
Bigger.
It's always been one that fascinated me. It's like you see a lot of operations, or at least in the nicer, smaller, jungly rivers there. They get a lot, but then it's like, where's that one spot? There's that place in like Concordia or whatever, below that dam, where they're always below that dam.
It's on.
Yeah, and there's those gigantically massive ones.
That's a different fishery again. I mean, it's in a dam. It's
big
water. It's not sexy.
No, I know. It's I'm like, but why are they so damn big there? But
a lot of food.
It's a big river.
Yeah,
big river, a lot of food. Yeah, but these fish are also big, and the river is it's wide, but it's shallow, so it's all wade fishing. Fishing from the bank, fishing from the rocks, stuff like this, looks fantastic, like spectacular scenery.
That's an area I want to travel to. You know, it's funny, those spotted cerubis, the big catfish there's almost as interesting to me as the Dorado. And I feel like that's a fish that people haven't really tapped into as much as they ought to. Or maybe I'm just not seeing it. Like, you know. That's a catfish that I think gets a lot bigger than what people realize and then like aren't showcasing for some reason. But I think they just live in the shadow of the sexier species of in the Dorado. But I'm like, if I went down there, I think I'd almost spend as much time trying to get one of those big cerubis. But
yeah, but they get big.
They get huge.
Yeah.
But I feel like they don't get showcased that often in these different areas for whatever reason. You don't see a lot of people going there specifically to catch those. They're like bycatch.
You catch them on artificials?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what I've heard, is a lot of people get them as bycatch. You know, in this side of it, I don't know how much I believe. I know a guy that's gone down there many, many times, and he says they get a lot of them in the tail, because he said supposedly they like slap at stuff with their tail to stun it. I'm like, well, is that what's happening, or are you just snagging them while you're throwing lures? Well, I don't know, but
it's possible some fish do this. So
yeah.
But
and they're predator.
Yeah,
catfish are basically predators. So maybe not super fast or spectacular like others, but
yeah,
that's a cool. Yeah.
It's an interesting species, but and I mean, I know y'all run some of these trips. I guess this is a good thing to ask as we kind of wrap it up. The people that see the videos, which eventually I'm going to be sharing it a lot as we get closer to releasing the podcast, and they're going to see all this stuff and wonder, what the hell? How do I get in on this action? How do they book? Where do they go? You know, Nikolai and Johan, how can people reach you? The website, how would they book a trip? How would they kind of plan maybe to get in on one of these expeditions?
Well, there's wildseaexpedition.com or email fishing@wildseaexpedition.com.
Instagram, Facebook page.
Yeah.
Nice.
Private message to us.
Yeah. Yeah, well, y'all were very receptive or very responsive to me, so I appreciate that, and I know people would probably be encouraged by that to know, well, you know, sometimes you send people a message and you never hear back. But that's awesome, guys. Man, I feel like I only scratched the surface on some of the things that you do and some of the places that you go. But you know, I don't want this to turn into a 7-hour podcast. Maybe you just break it break it into a 2-part thing and a talk again sometime. But y'all, for sure, I'm really looking forward to do what
after
now?
Next exploratory.
Yes. Big time. I want to know about the new stuff, but you know, I know you can't let the cat out of the bag. I tried to fool you into telling me your next secret spot you're going to go. But
mainly because it takes bad luck.
Yeah. Never let them know your next move. But Johan, Nikolai, I just want to say I appreciate y'all's time and receptiveness to doing this podcast. I really enjoyed it. I mean, the stuff that y'all are putting out, the videos, the photos, they're sensational. I think they're like top tier experiences in fishing, freshwater, saltwater, any of that. So I look forward to seeing more for my own. What's the word I'm looking for? I'm like selfish. My own selfish needs.
There's gonna be one very, very soon.
Good. Well, I look forward to it, guys. I appreciate your time. I know it's probably getting kind of late where you're at. It's just the middle of the day where I'm at, but. Yeah, I'm going to let you get to it, and let's stay in touch after this. Let me know when the next videos and stuff are coming out.
I'll send you.
Know. Sure. It's shortly.
Yeah.
Very shortly.
All right, guys. Well, I'll be watching, and I'm going to throw all the links up that I can find up on the screen, down in the caption. Anybody that's listening will be able to see it in the show notes. But I couldn't encourage you more to go check these guys' stuff out. It's I mean, as big as you can dream about a place to go fishing, it's in that dream category, I would say, what y'all are doing. So, yeah, something to work towards. But, guys, I appreciate your time. And, yeah, we'll be in touch.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
It's nice to hear the appreciation. So we also, yeah, we also enjoyed.
Yep, absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right, guys, have a good one.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Boundless Pursuit. Tune in each week as we bring stories and insight from uniquely talented anglers and outdoorsmen. And if you enjoyed this show, I want to hear from you. Be sure to leave a 5-star review, as this is going to drive the growth and exposure of this show. And if you have feedback or guest suggestions, I would love to hear from you. And you can reach me at boundlesspursuitfishing@gmail.com. For all other collections of media and contact information, please visit www.boundless-pursuit.com.